Finance Rules Committee meeting to order at 11:07, March 14th, 2006. For the record, present are Representative Guttenberg, Representative Coring, Speaker Harris, Representative Roakberg, Representative Coghill, and Representative Berkowitz. We have a quorum to do business. On today's order of business, we'll take up HB 489, the APOC bill. Then we'll move to SB 186, the Executive Ethics, and then thirdly, we'll take up HB 273, the Permanent Fund Dividend. All right. And therefore, the first order of business, we'll take up HB 486, and which is a bill of first impression for the legislature and this at this committee. It's got a single referral. 49. We do have to adopt the CS. Representative Coghill on the G version.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I was looking over something else. But then, Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt the CS for House Bill 49, version G, which is Wayne 3-1106. As our working draft.
Any objections to the adoption of the working draft? Seeing none, so adopted. We'd like to hear from Trevor Chenault or his staff. If you come forward and give us a presentation. And for the record, please, Ms. Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Lelania Snyder, staff to Representative Chenault. HB 489 would amend current statute to allow lobbyists to contribute to charitable events as long as it's been approved by Ledge Council. It would also allow persons covered by the Legislative Ethics Code to solicit and accept contributions to charity events from lobbyists so long as it's been approved by Ledge Council. Pretty simple. Your support of the legislation is appreciated. And if you have any questions, we have representatives from Legal, APOC, and Ethics here today.
Legal, APOC, and Ethics. Oh, good. So, for any questions on Ms. Snyder?
Mr. Chairman. Representative
Coring.
I haven't had a chance to actually look through the CS here, but I assume that it incorporates the recommendations by APOC then as far as the changes they wanted to see?
Through the chair, Rep. Coring, yes, it does.
Great. Thank you very much.
Representative Harris, sir.
Mr. Chairman. Laney, this is this bill came about because of the Fahrenheit Classic that we've had here for years. Thanksgiving in March, I think it's called charity event sort of thing. This in no way is meant to change the rules to affect lobbyists' contributions to legislators or any of that type of thing. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Rep. Harris, yes, it is.
Yeah, if I might, yeah, I would like just to follow up on that. This is changes, and we'll get some testimony to that effect. That the recommendations that we change the statute to basically allow what we've been doing, and that is soliciting donations for charity and using staff to invite people to participate in the events. And therefore, if we want to fight cancer or to support Bartlett Hospital or the USO, YMCA in Anchorage or various other charities, the food bank here in Southeastern, these are what the money is directed to. So, any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Kempton, please. Thank you for coming this morning, and for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Tammy Kempton. I'm the regulator of lobbying for the Alaska Public Offices Commission, and thank you for this opportunity today. I do have a copy of the CS. It has incorporated the concerns that I had expressed on this bill. So I really have one question, if that's all right, and then I'd be happy to answer questions that the committee might have. My question is on page 7, number 11, where it says a contribution to a charity event. And actually, it says the same thing on page 2, line 25, a contribution to a charity event. And what brought this issue to APOC's attention was a letter that was sent out soliciting for the Fahrenkamp Classic. We'd never been provided with a copy of this before, so we weren't aware of what went on in the Fahrenkamp Classic, just that such an event, charity event for very worthwhile causes, did take place. And our concern was one of the items that was asked for in this letter were donations of items for goodie bags for those putting. That is possibly not something that's going to go to the charity. In other words, whoever is putting is who's going to benefit from the gifts. We don't know what goodie bags are. We don't know what the gifts are that go in them. They could be something relatively minor, like tickets to the Gross Theater or tickets for, you know, coupons for coffee, or they could be Alaska Airline tickets. We just don't know. And so that's my question, is where in the bill, in the two spots, it says a contribution to a charity event. Does that include gifts that actually go in goodie bags that get distributed possibly to staff and legislators? If so, that is a concern.
Ms. Kempton, as a participant, a longtime participant in the event, actually the chair will take note that I won it once.
I think I can long, score it.
Long time ago, right? But I haven't been close recently. But I live in the golf balls. I'm not sure I recall goodie bags. I know many golf tournaments have goodie bags, which are usually small miscellaneous items. And I've donated things with company logos that are advertising themselves typically, but I suspect that if they were trying to put a goodie bag together, there would be it would be a donation from a business through the tournament to the participant. And many of there are legislators that participate, but there's actually the bulk of the participants are civilians. But as I guess I'd turn the question around on you, ma'am, and say, isn't there a restriction on the, of what is it, $250 of the amount of a gift that anybody can give to a active legislator? Would that be a cap in the other sections of the statute? Or
yes, that's correct.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill.
I think also we have under our ethics rules that we can't take anything that cannot be consumed from a lobbyist while we're in session.
Oh, that's right. So if the goodie bag was edible, we could take it, but not otherwise. Representative Harris.
My guess is that I don't remember goodie bags either, but my guess is that anything that would be in them would be something not from a lobbyist, but from the company. In other words, they have the company logo on them. They're either like a can opener or they're a letter opener, you know, some kind of stuff that they put out that has their advertisement on it that, you know, whether it be AT&T or it be Budweiser or whoever it is, these people that the corporate sponsors that put money toward these charities, they give out their, you know, sometimes their golf balls have their logo on them or something like that. And so they're not actually from the lobbyists at all, even though the lobbyists represent the companies here in this system. They aren't from the lobbyists. The lobbyist is just a figure for the corporation who actually does the donating.
Chairman Roekberg, Representative Harris, in that case, there's nothing in the law that prohibits the employer or client of a lobbyist from giving that type of a gift.
So they could put together, Mr. Chairman, the group could put together a goodie bag with those types of things in there as long as they came from the corporations.
Chairman Roepberg, Representative Harris, yes, that's correct.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. I most of the lobbyists I know around here don't personally give much of anything other than their time. They get it from their clients, and that's the pass-through type of a deal. Best I can tell to these charitable events.
Thank you. Representative Berkowitz, sir.
It seems to me that Section 3 of the bill, which describes AS 2460-080 sub-C, creates an exception that would seem to allow these kind of minimal gifts of hospitality.
Which page?
Page 5 and 6.
Are you referring to something in the current law?
You could construe these gifts to be gifts that would be consumed under subsection 6, they're not connected with the recipient's legislative status, or it's not a violation to accept hospitality. And I don't believe, not define hospitality, but.
Ms. Kempton, please, if you could respond.
Chairman Roepberg, Representative Berkowitz, yes, that's true, but this particular section applies to legislators. In the lobbying law, as it stands currently, a lobbyist is only allowed to give food and beverage for immediate consumption during session or tickets to a pre-approved charity event. And, of course, the problem with the Fahrenkamp classic is that there isn't a need for tickets for it, and that's why this issue has come up.
If I might point out, there is the tickets, if you will, for the team entry that's historically has been there have been invited members to play along with other non-members in teams, and then whoever captains the team or underwrites it pays the entry fee. I'm not sure you were aware of that.
No, sir, I was not.
So you could say there would be a ticket in that regard or an entry fee, which is required, but that goes into the charitable contribution. Does that clarify anything?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
This would allow a lobbyist who might sponsor that, though, to be able to contribute to that to the charity.
That would be my assumption, Representative Harris. Representative Berkowitz, does that clarify anything, or did you have a follow-up?
No, just raising a point.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Harris.
If I'm reading this correctly, and I think I am, the Section 3 that you're talking about is already in law. The only change is Section 11 that's been added.
Which refers back to Section 10.
Right.
It's a classic redundancy here.
Everything else is in law now.
Well, that's the intention here. This bill is intended not to change a conduct that's been occurring now. It's just to sanction the activities of charitable fundraising on part of the legislature, so as to not inhibit the ability to be a conduit for contributions that go to charity, and in no way would be a benefit to the member other than a morning or afternoon of enjoyment in the Capitol building. So we do have one more witness, incidentally, Ms. Anderson. So any further questions? Thank you. If you might want to stand by in case there's a follow-up, Ms. Kempton, thank you. Joyce, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you very well. Please, if you could, for the record, introduce yourself and your affiliation and give your testimony, please.
Yes, I'm Joyce Anderson, Administrator for the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. And I do have a couple of comments, Mr. Chairman, if I may go ahead.
Please.
First of all, what I'd like to say is that in 1994, the Ethics Committee did issue an advisory opinion that allowed legislators and legislative staff to receive, solicit and accept and receive charitable contributions from lobbyists. So So basically on the ethics end, we have had not had a problem with what the issue is today. So I'd like to point that out. And that in that advisory opinion, it talks about auction items, money, those sort of things, all of the proceeds that would go to charity. I'm glad that Ms. Kempton raised the issue about other donations, such as goodie bags and so forth. That was going to be my question. I know in Advisory Opinion 9406, the committee has said that as long as the contribution that was received from a lobbyist by legislators and legislative staff had no financial benefit to the individual, which would be the legislator and the staff person, then there was no problem. They also had said in that particular advisory opinion that the identity of the recipient of a gift does make a difference in whether the solicitation is prohibited. So I guess I agree with your comments, Chairman Roper, that the intent of this is not to allow solicitations for, like we were talking about earlier, if you want to use the word goodie bags and so forth, that it would be strictly solicitations on behalf of the charity itself, which would be, like I said, either auction items or money and so forth. So I'm very much in agreement with that. And as stated, I believe, by both the committee and Ms. Kempton, is that this is not really changing anything the way it is right now with either organizations, corporations, private individuals, and so forth that are contributing to charity events. It's just clearing up an inconsistency in the ethics law in relation to the lobbying law. And unaware of the fact, as Ms. Kempton said, that this wasn't allowed on their end. I do have one other thing, though, I'd like to point out to the committee, and that in that advisory opinion, the committee did note that, let me just read a quote from the advisory opinion. It says, therefore, you may solicit a charitable contribution from a lobbyist during a legislative session. The committee notes that the potential for the appearance of impropriety is high when legislators and legislative employees request favors of lobbyists, even on behalf of worthwhile organizations. The committee therefore urges you to use caution in making a decision about whether to approach a lobbyist, especially during a legislative session. I just wanted to point that out to the committee, that concern. And in that light, I am wondering, based on the discussion by the committee and Ms. Kempton, if we did want to change the word contribution in the statute to say charitable contribution, even though there may be some redundancy there, which would say a charitable contribution to a charity event, which would then limit it to donations that would be going just to the charity versus what we discussed earlier about goodie bags and so forth. So I'm going to throw that suggestion out to the committee. The other suggestion that I'm throwing out to the committee is that there are a lot of disclosure requirements right now in the statute, in the ethics statute regarding gifts of travel, hospitality, gifts of legal services, and gifts if a family member goes with you on a trip and so forth. So I'm wondering if the committee wants to include maybe disclosure of gifts received by legislators and legislative staff from lobbyists for charity events. And again, I just throw that out for a suggestion. Thank you.
Question, Ms. Anderson. Joyce, I it would be my considered opinion. I think I understand the distinction you're trying to make, but I think the syntax and the sentence construction would be redundant, albeit I think I understand what you're getting at. Your last recommendation, though, could you repeat that again? I'm not sure I fully understood that.
Basically, what it would be is that when legislators and staff members receive gifts for a pre-approved charity event through Ledge Council, which would be, what, four or five functions a year, I'm not quite sure, they would just disclose that as a gift that they've received and given to the charity, similar to disclosure that you do right now when you receive a gift for attending a legislative meeting and you put down so-and-so paid for your travel or whatever it has to be.
No, Mr. Chairman, I'll tell you what, I'm going to disagree with that entirely. We got enough to do around here as it is. If we got to disclose every time we go ask somebody for something for charity, I'm not going to do it. And I got to tell you, I'm one of the leaders around here that's been working on this damn thing for years. And, you know, if you think it's a lot of fun and games, I mean, I'd take a big exception to that. It takes a lot of hard work, and it's usually the finance chairman that has to do it and gets very little help from very few other people. So, quite frankly, we're trying to help out very worthwhile charities. And it's a lot of hard work, and, you know, if you put so many restrictions on it, I'll for one, will stop. And you can be responsible for the charities not getting their money then.
Well, yeah, I think it'd be very difficult to assign some reporting requirement to somebody who has perhaps staff or other people working on it, and there's no real direct connection there. It's a very difficult thing to do. So I think that would be unnecessary, and I would disagree based on paperwork reduction theories, if nothing else.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman.
And I appreciate Speaker Harris's comments here. Representative Kako.
If the member actually received the contribution, I could see that as a needed thing, but they don't actually receive it.
All they receive would be the being a member of the team. If there was somebody, it'd be a lobbyist or otherwise, paid for their team membership, you know, which goes directly to charity. It just allows them to participate. So, but that would be underneath the rule, which would require disclosure now, right? You don't, unless you get up there, you don't need to require, you don't need to disclose it, unless you're over $250. Is that right? Yeah. So that would actually miss the current rule. So everybody understand? Further questions of Ms. Anderson? Seeing none, is there anybody else that wishes to testify on House Bill 489, an act relating to the treatment of charity events by the Alaska Public Office Commission under the law governing legislative ethics?
Chairman.
Representative Harris.
I'd like to move that we move from committee SES for House Bill 489, G version, Wayne, individual recommendations, and attached fiscal notes if there are any.
Any objection? Seeing none, so moved. Thank you very much. Next, we're going to take up Senate Bill 186. Okay. We'll take a brief at ease. Back to order. Senator Seekins, sir, for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Senator Ralph Seekins from the Fairbanks and Denali Borough Districts, District D. Mr. Chairman and members, Senate Bill 186 is a bill that we started working on quite some time ago, and it has come to you today, and I just wanted to give you just a quick presentation of some of the of how it got to you today. And so if here I can move down here. One of the things that I found out is that most people don't have never read the Executive Ethics Act. Especially legislators, we aren't as concerned about ours as we are theirs as we are about ours. And so there's a tremendous misunderstanding of what the code does. The code basically says that it's declared that a high moral and ethical standards among public officers in the executive branch are essential to assure the trust, respect, and confidence of the people of this state. And a code of ethics for the guidance of the public officers will discourage those officers from acting upon personal or financial interests in the performance of their public responsibilities, improve standards of public service, and promote and strengthen the faith and confidence of the people of this state in their public officers. Holding public officer employment is a public trust, and that as one safeguard of that trust, the people require public officers to adhere to a code of ethics. Now, it is declared, a fair and open government requires that the executive branch public officers conduct the public's business in a manner that preserves the integrity of the governmental process and avoids conflicts of interest. In order for the rules governing conduct to be respected, both during and after leaving public service, the code of ethics must be administered fairly, without bias or favoritism. No code of conduct, however comprehensive, can anticipate all situations in which violations may occur, nor can it prescribe behaviors that are appropriate to every situation. In addition, laws and regulations regarding ethical responsibilities cannot legislate morality, eradicate corruption, or eliminate bad judgment. And compliance with a code of ethics is an individual responsibility. Thus, all who serve the state have the solemn responsibility to avoid improper conduct and prevent improper behavior by colleagues and subordinates. Members, Mr. Chairman, our ethics laws must be very clear, must be very fair, and must be very enforceable. In order to do that, we had to do This very simple task of making, when we were asked to review these by our majority in the Senate, we found out that I felt more like a character in Walt Disney's The Wonderful Tar Baby than I did as a senator, because the harder we fought this issue, the stickier it got, Mr. Chairman.
Here's one of my relatives wrote that, didn't he, at the bottom of there?
Yeah. Joel Chandler Harris wrote that. Yes, he did.
Is that a conflict of interest?
It must be, yeah.
Yeah. This is the drawer of the research that we went through in this process. We looked at all the different state laws. We looked at municipal codes. We looked at bar association codes. We looked at judicial conduct commissions and more. And there, we found there is no uniform ethics code model out there. Everybody handles it differently. Well, what brought this to issue in the first place was, if you remember, in the Rankus issue, Mr. Bundy said he could not find a clear, bright line as to the investment of the Attorney General as to whether it constituted a violation. So part of our charge was to establish a clear, bright line. In doing that, we essentially followed the Bundy recommendations. And we found there's no impropriety if interest is of a type possessed generally by the public or a large class of persons to which the employee belongs. Action or influence would have insignificant or conjectural effect on the matter. Interest is held in a blind trust. This is what we suggested and was amended out. Or the public officer does not have management control over the financial interest. Or interest in a matter in regard to a business, and the employee does not own a controlling interest in the business, does not own more than 1% of the stock in the business, and the stock owner has a value of less than $10,000, owns an equity interest in the business worth less than $10,000, is not a member of the board of directors or another governing body of the business, is not an elected officer of the business, does not provide personal or professional services to the business, does not have a contract with the business, and is not an employee of the business. In a previous committee, it was amended also on stock options, or ownership options were added as part of that. Part of our charge was to find any other black holes in the statute and to see if there was something in there that needed to be fixed while we were there. Well, one of them that we found was in the area of confidentiality. And here's an interesting part of the Executive Act. Confidentiality in the Executive Act only applies to current or former public officers. Doesn't apply to anyone else. So what is a public officer? Mr. Chairman, a public officer is a public employee, a member of a board or commission, and a state officer designated by the governor to act as a trustee or a person with trust duties, such as permanent fund member of the board of trustees. So it only applies, once again, to current and former public officers. It does not apply to any other person. It applies during the investigation and until a finding of probable cause by the Attorney General and formal proceedings are initiated. After service, after that finding of probable cause and after service, the complaint is a public record. There are 24 steps in the process, and this is at step 12 of the investigation. Knowingly, and in our proposal that came over from the Senate, knowingly and intentionally making a complaint public, or knowingly and intentionally causing it to be made public prior to a finding of probable cause, and service of the complaint by any person would have been a misuse of the act. The penalty in law, currently in law, for public employees would now apply to everyone. Let me read to you what the statute says the penalty is for breaking any part of this chapter, including the confidentiality requirements. The personnel board may impose on a current or former public officer civil penalties not to exceed $5,000 for a violation of this chapter. So, if you break confidentiality and you're not a public employee, there's no penalty. If you're a public employee, there is up to a $5,000 penalty. We suggested that the law should apply to everyone equally. We suggested that I grew up in a family of seven kids. If my mom said to me, she said, Ralph, if I let you do that, I have to let all the other six kids do it. And that's a basic principle under the law. When Lady Justice no longer has a blindfold, everything falls apart. If Lady Justice has to peek through first and say, well, are you a public employee or are you not a public employee, all kinds of havoc reigns. We suggest, and I suggest, that if you're not going to have an equal confidentiality requirement for everyone, you throw out all confidentiality requirements. The law should apply equally, and Lady Justice should be blindfolded. The next issue that we found was the issue of blind trusts. The American Bankers Association's definition of a blind trust is a trust set up to prevent the owner from having detailed knowledge of assets in the trust. Government officials frequently use blind trusts to avoid conflicts of interest between their official duties and personal financial transactions. We have many successful people that enter into government in, for example, commissioner positions as a capstone to their career. They have investments. They have an investment portfolio. And in some cases, the most qualified person to work on an issue for the government is someone who may have a potential conflict of interest because of the ownership that they have in our portfolio. One of the things that happens in a blind trust before you get to that would be, under the Act, there has to be full disclosure of the assets. It's a requirement of the Act. A public officer has to give that full disclosure. Then there has to be, when that public officer understands that there is a potential violation, has to make a declaration of potential violation. That is required now by the Act. And as at that point in time, that person must refrain from taking any official action relating to the matter until a determination is made, and immediately disclose the matter in writing to his or her designated supervisor and the Attorney General. It allows the designated supervisor one more option for a highly qualified individual to work on behalf of the state on a particular project, with full disclosure, with a declaration, and now the supervisor has the option, said, we want you to take your interest and put it in a blind trust, where you don't have that ability to control it. I suggest, again, our objective in writing this bill, and you see the bill before you, and these are the two issues that I did want to bring before you today, is that our ethics laws must be clear, they must be fair, and they must be enforceable. And Lady Justice must wear a blindfold. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm willing to answer any questions that you may have.
Any questions of the committee? Senator Seekins, some general questions for the record. Throughout the bill, the reference is made to business associates and what a person, quote, knows or reasonably ought to know. So it would appear that the definition of business associate would not cover a minority ownership or an LLC where the covered official is a limited partner. Is that correct, or a member?
That's how I understand it, Mr. Chairman. If you were a minority member, you shouldn't know what you would not reasonably know, nor would you know what other investments one of your business associates in an LLC may have. However, if you're a business associate, like for an example, I may have a partner in an automobile related business, and that I should reasonably know that associate of mine has a conflict of interest having to do with automobile or automobile law or automobile transactions. And so it's a term of art on reasonably ought to know, and it's not with a very wide brush.
We'll follow it up. So actually, I recently had an experience where I had to make a distinction as an LLC member about whether I was a managing member or a non-managing member for IRS purposes, because it had to do with self-employment tax. Therefore, the accountants would designate, or you'd make a determination whether you were essentially a majority managing partner or a minority non-managing member of an LLC. Is that basically the distinction you're making here? Or something of that.
You're pretty close to that. I believe you're pretty close there, Mr. Chairman. It's not. It's. It's. Uh, If you look at how that requirement goes, that's a list of people, including your mother, your brother, your sister, you know, that if you reasonably should know that they're involved in a business that would constitute a conflict of interest. It's not like you're supposed to absolutely know everything about every one of your business associates.
Right, Mr. Chairman. I guess that's what has got me a little disturbed, because how, if for example, you're appointed to, let's say, a commissionership or a high office within the executive branch, and you turn your business over to an associate, how are you supposed to know what he's thinking?
But you should have some idea of, just a reasonable idea if that involves a conflict of interest with that person. I guess that's the hard part. It's that reasonably ought to know, that where you should not be taking advantage of your particular position for his benefit or her benefit, or putting that person in a position of let me see if I remember correctly, but it's a state of art when we looked at it on reasonably ought to know, and it isn't in our definition terms, but I don't recall exactly what it was. But it is not that you absolutely should know about everything that your aunt, your uncle, your brother, your sister. I mean, I have six brothers and sisters, and I don't have an idea what they have an investment in. But if my brother and I were in the same investment group and we had a pretty good idea of what our crossed investments might be, then there's a reasonable assumption that I would know, because I was in an investment group with him, and at that point it would be a disclosable item.
Well, what if you're a business associate owned 1,000 shares of Oracle, and the state was making a deal with Oracle? That would be over the $10,000 limit.
If you were over the $10,000 limit or the 1%, you'd have to declare it.
It'd be declared because it'd be on your conflict of interest.
You'd have to declare a conflict to your supervisor. If you recall back here a ways,
even though your ownership was already,
you'd have to put a declaration of potential violation in, and you'd have to refrain at that point from taking any official action until the determination is made, you'd have to immediately disclose the matter in writing to the designated.
That's if you had a blind trust.
Now, if you didn't have the blind, if you had it in a blind trust up at the front part, you wouldn't have to do that, because you wouldn't know what was in your blind trust if your asset portfolio was there. However, there's two scenarios. The second scenario would be your designated supervisor would say, "Well, you can go ahead and work on this, but as part of this condition, I'm either going to ask you to divest yourself of it, or I'm going to have you put it in a blind trust." For the period of time that you're working on it, where you don't have any direct control over its buying or selling of the shares or the investment. So it was meant to just try to take it out of your direct control. You would still know that you potentially had an investment there, but it's fully declared, it's fully disclosed, fully declared, and it's a decision, an option of a decision that would be made by your ethics supervisor.
Representative Rickwitz.
Is there a definition of blind trust somewhere?
Well, it's not in the bill now, but it's been removed, but then there's the definition. Was that in the bill before?
No. That is the definition from the American Bankers Association, and have no problem putting a definition into a statute. I don't think it's in there.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rickwitz.
If there are other definitions of blind trust, perhaps legal definitions, those might be helpful. This little bag, and it also, you have to figure that anytime you add a definition of a trust, it's got to intersect with the other parts of the state trust and estate statutes, which are fairly complex and fairly well integrated.
I didn't hear that last part.
I think Representative Berkowitz is referring to our voluminous trust laws that Alaska has done intentionally to establish the trust business in Alaska, and that if we were to define or have a blind trust, it would not want to be in conflict with those particular current statutes. Did you look at that when you were?
No, but I've got two major revisions to the trust laws, and I've been through them pretty extensively over the last 3 years, and I don't see that there would be a conflict. I'm more than happy to research that for you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, a blind trust is in the U.S. Congress, it's used. There are other places, many state laws use blind trusts, and we can get a definition if you'd prefer. I don't think there is one in statute.
Well, it's a good question, because it'd be my plan today to offer an amendment to place a blind trust back in the statute. So you might give that some thought, Representative Berkowitz, if we want to define that further.
It's not my intent to support the amendment, Mr. Chair, so I'm not here to help you.
Oh, you're following that old adage, right? Representative Senator Sequencer, right?
I'd be more than happy to assist you with that, and I've spent quite a bit of time in the trust statutes, but there are many different types of trusts, and what we've dealt with in most of our laws in the state of Alaska have to do with personal trusts and not with blind trusts.
Moving on here right now, just a couple of general questions. I don't see a definition of a campaign period in the bill. Do we need a definition of that? Or we have there's a current definition in 2460.030.
Campaign period applies more to the Legislative Ethics Act than it does to the Executive Ethics Act, but if it's not there and we need to have it in there, then I'd have no objection to putting the same campaign period in there that's for the Legislative Ethics Act.
And also, just could you comment on, there's a household definition indicates a social unit. What do you envision by a social unit?
There are many relationships in the world today. There's families, there's social units, and they're hard to define as far as all the relationships are concerned. A close social unit could be two fellows that have been living together for the last 20 years, but it's basically trying to say, you know, there are many relationships that very closely approximate those of family units, and this is meant to say that a group that's a very close social unit, there could be a potential conflict of interest if you're working on their behalf against the state.
What if you had two or three people rooming together or something, where under the Legislative Ethics Law they would be economic associates, but would that apply in this instance?
If you were working on their behalf and against the best interest of the state, that is one of the groups that we would look at.
Very good. Further questions of Senator Seekins? Seeing none, I'm going to stand by. Does anybody else wish to testify on?
And Mr. Chairman, I really thank you for allowing us to present this portion of the bill. I have found that many of the people who comment on the bill on a regular basis have never read the act, and that don't understand the provisions even of what we're suggesting, nor have they ever taken the time to report that these requirements, these confidentiality requirements and civil penalty requirements, apply to state employees but not to anyone else. So those who are most defending of everyone's right of free speech, you know, I find that I defend it as well, but I really encourage everyone to read the act before they get too far out on the limb and find out that there's 15,000 state employees who then would be held responsible for breaking confidentiality when nobody else in the state has to, and that they face that penalty for breaking confidentiality when no one else in the state has to. And so attempting to even that playing field, I think, is a task that we were trying to do here. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Senator. Does anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 186? My adult conference. Seeing now, I'll close public testimony. I'm going to stand by, Senator, in case we have some questions here. I think in your bill packets, gentlemen, we have an amendment. It says, it's designated P.1, Wayne 3606. I mark it as amendment number one, and I move amendment number one.
Object for purposes of discussion.
I hear at least two objections, so we have before us amendment number one. What this does is just puts the blind trust provisions back in the bill that were apparently removed in the House State Affairs Committee. I'm doing this because I believe strongly that the mechanism of blind trust should be available, and it's difficult enough to recruit competent people in the state of Alaska. We are a very small state, and people tend to have interlocking business interests and other things that I think that there are going to be are currently made, the public is made aware of them by disclosure, and this would allow a more typical portfolio to be continued and managed and allow that person to participate as Senator Sinkins says, perhaps as a career capstone or a career-ending type contribution of public service, and not to have to divest themselves of their investment portfolios. And Senator Sinkins, if I could ask this time, my understanding is the way your bill was constructed with him, that that if they didn't have a blind trust prior to an appointment, say, by the governor, that but in either way, there would be a full disclosure of the contents of it before it was blind. Is that correct?
That's correct. If when you enter, you have to make that disclosure statement, as I understand the law. If later you put it in a blind trust, everyone would know what's in that blind trust. If you had
going in, but then it would be blind.
Yeah. So, but you have no control over the what's sold and what's not sold, what's retained, what's not retained. The person controlling that trust has the ability to do that. And here, Mr. Chairman, I just throw out one little question. I would bet that the man who's occupying the office on the third floor today probably owns some bank stock. And should we now say that that person should sell that that bank stock and be forced to take the tax consequences of that in order to make any decision having to do with regulation of banking in the state of Alaska? Or could he be allowed to put that in a blind trust in a petition of conflict of interest? And I think, as I said earlier, there's two ways you can use a blind trust. First, you can say there is no conflict if your assets are in a blind trust. And secondly, if you find that there is a conflict in something that you own, then you have to do the declaration. You have to let your supervisor know. You've had it disclosed ahead of time what your assets are. Then you have to let your designated ethics supervisor know, that person and the attorney general at the same time. And then that person at that point makes a decision, says, you can go forward and continue to work on this project if you put this in a blind trust. Or you have to divest yourself of that interest if you're going to do it, or you can't work on it. You can't do it. But it's with full disclosure. It's totally on the record. It's out there for everyone to see. And in some case, with let's take Attorney General Rankus, based on his background, he had a great deal of experience in that particular interest at the time. The governor may have said, and the ethics supervisor may have said, put it in a blind trust and continue to work on this project. We need your expertise. That's an option that should be available with full disclosure. Nothing should be behind closed doors. Nothing should be in the dark of night, but it should be totally in view, and that's what this would do. It would just give that one more option for that ethics supervisor.
I'm not entirely comfortable with that, but I mean, Representative Berkowitz.
I think is that the initial supposition from the senator's answer is incorrect. No one is saying that he has to sell his bank assets upstairs. They're saying if you have a conflict, don't participate in the decision or divest. There's no requirement. There's a choice. And I think anyone who has a conflict always has that choice.
Or put it in a blind trust, Mr. Chairman.
No, that's not currently part of statute.
I agree.
That's Senator Seekers. Representative Harris.
Well, something seems strange to me. Representative Berkowitz brought up a point. But let's just say you're elected governor, and you have already done these business deals, and you've been involved in whatever your life, and you have
I'm
this stuff.
I'm paying particular attention here now.
I understand. You could you could be under this scrutiny if you're not careful. So then you have done all this, and the public elects you as governor, okay? And you obviously at that point in time are the chief executive officer of the state of Alaska. You have to be involved in every decision that's made some way, shape, or form because the buck ultimately stops at the top, right? So what are you going to do? You have a choice of either putting something in a blind trust, divesting of it, or not making an action. I mean, not making an action is not a plausible thing to say because as governor, you've got to make an action. It's your constitutional duty to make an action, or I'll step down as governor. I mean, you know, so something seems out of whack here to me. That why couldn't you just do full disclosure and the public will understand that anyway going in and if you're gonna rule up beside of your public disclosure conflicts, you do. You know, I don't know.
Well, if I could represent Berkowitz, as much as you're as close to the situation as anybody, then I would ask if a bill were to be enacted by the legislature, and assuming the governor had banking stocks in his portfolio, would you recommend that the governor allow that bill to either, one, become law without action, and or in the alternative, veto it? By taking any kind of action, be it positive or negative, I mean, how would you view that situation then? If he didn't have the alternative of blind trust?
Well, there's eight suggested alternatives that currently exist in the judiciary version. If he doesn't own a controlling interest in the business, it's not a problem. If he doesn't own more than 1% of the stock in the business, the stock has a value of less than $10,000, it's not a problem. If he owns an equity interest less than $10,000, it's not a problem. Is not a member of a board of directors, is not an elected officer, frankly, I don't think anyone who's governor should be an elected officer of any business. I think there's just a built-in conflict with that.
Should resign, that's right. Yeah.
Doesn't provide personal or professional services to the business. I again see there's, when you're the governor, or I think to some extent when you're any ranking official, you shouldn't be providing other services. It's just a breeding ground for corruption. You don't have contract and you're not an employee. So the instances that you're talking about would be relatively few and far between. And if there was specific legislation that addressed the banking industry, I don't think the governor should participate in it if he has a controlling interest in a business. And to my knowledge, he does not.
Mr. Chairman, it's not a controlling interest. Senator Seekins. It's a $10,000 interest. Not a controlling interest. I disagree with Representative Berkowitz. That's not what it is. It's a $10,000 interest. And we have said that the reason we're here is because these things are few and far between and we got caught in that crack. And so consequently, we're saying if we're going to address this in the future, a $10,000 investment for some folks is not a huge amount of money. I realize to other people it's a huge amount of money. But it's someone owning... I only own shares in my own corporation, so I don't have a problem here. But when you're looking at someone who has been a successful individual, that they are serving as a capstone, they may own $10,000 worth of mining stock or $10,001 worth of banking stock. What we're saying here is with full disclosure and with a letter to the Attorney General and the Ethics Supervisor and saying, I have a conflict here, what can we do? This just adds one more option to 3952210, which says reassign duties to cure the employee's potential violation, if feasible, or direct the divestiture or removal by the employee of the personal or financial interests that give rise to the potential violation, second option. Third option, place it in a blind trust where you have no control.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berkowitz.
You know, we've never had an instance where the governor's had this kind of conflict, but it seems to me that if the governor does have that kind of conflict, then the governor is, in effect, incapacitated for that particular bill, and the responsibility for signature or veto or whatever course of action would fall to the lieutenant governor. And that's an appropriate thing. We've never had this problem. I don't want to design a system for the instance that hasn't happened with the governor's situation. When you have, your proposal is going to be to create a blind trust. There's a couple of problems with that. First of all, we don't know what a blind trust is. Second of all, the circumstances under which the blind trust are created don't necessarily mean that the individual whose assets are held in the blind trust doesn't know what's in them. So, for example, you could be in a situation where someone has a blind trust, you know what's in the blind trust, and you decide to sell the assets in order to capitalize on an official action. That's a problem. So the stark choice created under the current statutory scheme, which is either you reassign duties or else you divest, seems an accurate thing to happen. And you know, you can run to the top of the hierarchy and complain about what's going to happen to the governor, but it's really about the 15,000 other people that we're concerned about here who make daily decisions that impact the lives of Alaskans on a regular basis.
And true, on Senator Seekins.
Chairman, I don't know that we had a provision anywhere in our statutes or our constitution for the lieutenant governor to sign a bill.
Nor did I.
I guess I learned something new there today. But the second version is, I use that as an example. I can give you other examples of people who come into work in government in positions as commissioners, on boards, on commissions. All of these people fall subject to this law. And with the full disclosure that we have, and where everyone knows what their investment is, and with having consulted with their ethics supervisor, I think we're protected from somebody sneaking around in the dark and trying to do something wonderful for themselves. But we're giving that person the opportunity to use their expertise for the benefit of the state. That's all this is, nothing more.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berkowitz.
The reason we have ethics is so we have a democracy, not a kleptocracy, to make sure that people don't use their official government positions in order to enhance their own personal positions. And if it becomes a problem for someone, and I have never seen anyone in any system of government who is absolutely irreplaceable, if there is an inescapable conflict, then you oughtn't be involved in government. And it's as simple as that. Take your vast talents and go somewhere else. And you can go back and sell cars in Fairbanks if that's your choice, if it's a problem.
And just for the record, Section 9, Article 3 of our Constitution is that the acting governor, in case of the temporary absence of the governor from office, the lieutenant governor shall serve as an acting governor. So it'd have to be temporarily. He'd have to be absent. So I don't think that's appropriate. But
glad we're chasing that wild goose.
Yes, right. It is a wild goose. My concern is, as the senator just indicated, the 15 or so thousand people that could be subject to this act, any one of which could serve in any capacity in government that has their own keyhole or retirement plan, they're a small business person, they can easily have a seven-figure retirement equivalent to most state workers now for benefits. And they would have a broad stock portfolio of mutual funds, exchange-traded funds, and individual equity positions, bonds, etc. Very, very understandable. You know, for those people to be forced to liquidate their portfolio to serve the government, even for a dollar a year, I don't think is at all appropriate. I think them having a mechanism that allows that individual to have a blind trust so they may serve the government is most appropriate. And that is the basis of why I brought the amendment forward, And I think that's quite defensible. Representative Berkowitz.
2 points. First of all, again, we still don't know what a blind trust is, at least as far as the statutes go. And secondly, I'd love to see some examples of where this has created a problem. All we've had so far is mention of the Rankus incident, and that was a pretty clear-cut incident of a conflict. It might have been a little difficult under the statutes, but there's clear, bright lines that we could insert into statutes that would fix it. But show me some other examples before we create a huge, sweeping change to the statutory scheme.
Well, I think there is bright lines in here, and the $10,000 bright line is there. That's the one reason I believe that a blind trust is appropriate. And therefore, you don't have to liquidate your entire portfolio, which is, you know, owning $10,000 of an equity position is relatively small. I mean, that's 100 shares of a $100 share is $10,000, or 1,000 shares of a $10 share. I mean, those are not uncommon positions in most portfolios. So I don't understand your objection.
My objection is, I don't know what a blind trust is. It can be written in such a way that you have a loophole that swallows the rule. Secondly, we're curing a problem that no one has shown me that actually exists. Show me some instances in the executive branch where there have been these conflicts of interest that couldn't have been solved under the bill as it's coming before us. Give me some not hypotheticals about the governor and the lieutenant governor, but show me a number of cases that actually exist. Show me where the system is broken before you prescribe this standard.
Well, if I sat out for a year and was asked for an appointment or was appointed to an executive position, I'd have to do the same thing. I'd have to liquidate my entire retirement portfolio or major parts of it, because it wouldn't be consistent with the act as to $10,000. So, I mean, I think that's a very common instance, particularly with somebody that's been involved in business as a self-employed business person for any length of time. Very common. Representative Harris.
Along that same line, I appreciate Representative Berkowitz's concern. And what if you were a fairly long-term employee of the state, had built up a retirement system under the old PERS system, and then you were selected to be the commissioner of administration? Mm-hmm. I mean, you'd have obviously a lot more than $10,000 worth of retirement built up. Would you have to then liquidate your retirement to less than or to $10,000 or less? Would you not be able to participate in any decisions or issues involving the retirement system, which of course is part and parcel of the Department of Administration? I don't know.
I can answer.
I'm not trying to be smart aleck about it. He just brings up that issue. Would somebody who was commissioner of administration have to be somebody who never participated in the state's retirement system, for instance? Or
Senator Seekins, if you wish to handle that.
No, you would not have to do that, because that would be, you're a member of a large group of people, and that is exempt. If you were part of the retirement system, you have no control over that. You're just another one of the members of a large group of positions that own those interests. And so that would not be a conflict under the law at this point, and it remains that way. However, the one good example is the Rankus example. We didn't have any clear, bright line. But had we had one, the governor may have said, as the Attorney General's ethics supervisor, you know, I want you, one, to divest yourself of the interest, have nothing more to do with the project, or place it in a blind trust with full disclosure. So that is exactly one example that we found. And the reason we're here today was because we didn't think of that example before. We didn't think of that before, and it came on us. And so we're trying to avoid those kinds of situations with some reasonable and full disclosure on the part of somebody who may work in state government who may have a potential conflict. And the governor may have said, Greg, you're the man on this coal project, and I want you to do it, but you're going to have to put that in a blind trust. He tried to put it in somewhat of a blind trust, but it really wasn't, if you recall. He still had quarterly reports on it and a few other things. But so because of that stumbling around, we've tried to look at a way that we can continue to keep those people involved without forcing them to divest themselves of an interest that it would be fully disclosed.
Any further discussion? Representative Guttenberg.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would much rather have full disclosure and have everybody understand the ramifications for the individual who is making the decisions than a blind trust, because I think in many ways a blind trust is a smokescreen in front of that, that you could hide behind that, that it's a mirror or a cloud that you could hide behind and make decisions that would affect it. Now, you know, we can't plan for every action or, you know, what everybody's going to do in the future, but I would simply rather have something up front. Let us see what's going on. Let us see the ramifications. I mean, it's between the two of them. One is visible and one is hidden. Now, you might have control of the blind trust in some way that's not direct or related. You know, historically, we've seen that happen in the past with some chief executives. You know, it's been historic. It's been written about. I would just assume it was right up in front, and we could see it and know what was going on, and it would be part of the public record. Otherwise, it's just hidden behind a cloud or a wall or a blind trust, which, you know, if we're going to define what a blind trust is, we're doing it after this amendment. But just to know what's going on, that it is visible, is, I think it's more important than the actions that one individual would have, that we should balance those between someone who might have a conflict, who might not, we don't know, but just to have it out in front and not to put it behind a closed door or put it in a black box and think that there is no control of it.
And Mr. Chairman,
Representative Singh, excuse me.
Under 3952-270, a public officer is required to do a full disclosure, and that disclosure has to be screened by their designated ethics supervisor. And if they detect in there that there could be their ownership position might result in a violation of the chapter, then that designated supervisor has to go back to those other steps. You can't do it. You have to divest, or you could put it in a blind trust if you have the blind trust in there. So there is a screening process that starts from the very beginning and continues forward.
So it'd be your testimony that would indicate that the asset would have to be disclosed in any way, and I think that would overcome, I think, to a degree, Representative Guttenberg's argument that it's not disclosed. So.
And screened. Yes.
So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berkowitz.
You know, it's fascinating, this discussion about blind trust and how we have to insert this in here. But you know, there's an amazing thing that happens when you read the statutes. 3950-040, titled, take a guess, Mr. Chair.
Blind trust.
Very good, speaker. Huh? Says, it's already here. A public official may transfer all or a portion of the official's assets to a blind trust for the duration of service in public office. The original assets placed in the blind trust shall be listed by the official in the statement required to be filed under this chapter. The instrument creating the blind trust must be included in the statement. For a trust to qualify under this section, assets transferred to the trust shall be marketable. The trustee shall be a bank or other institutional fiduciary. The trustee shall have full authority to manage the trust, including the purchase, sale, and exchange of its assets in accordance with fiduciary principles. Information regarding the identity and nature of its assets shall be confidential from the trustor for the duration of the trust. The trustee shall be required to report any known breach of confidentiality or the termination of the trust to the office where the trustor is required to file statements.
And Mr. Chairman,
the representative, Senator Steele,
there's still no allowance in the ethics law for the accommodation of that blind trust.
Right.
I'm sorry.
What's your point, Representative Berkowitz?
My point is that once you get elected or once you become a public official, there's nothing that prohibits you from setting up a blind trust. Nothing.
That's true, but there's nothing that
allowing
you don't have a conflict of interest if there's something there. And so you're accommodating a blind trust, and Representative Berkowitz is right. I had stopped my review at the end of definitions here, and I did know that was there, and I'd forgotten it. But the there's still not the ability in a potential conflict of interest to utilize blind trusts, or that blind trusts remove you from that first conflict. That's what this bill would do.
Precisely. So all we're doing is memorializing in this particular section what's already in law.
Well, you're allowing the utilization of blind trusts in ethics situations.
Right.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Harris.
First of all, President Berkowitz, is there a definition of blind trust in the statute there?
No. It describes what a trust has to do in order to qualify.
Okay. Senator Seekins, do you support Amendment Number 1?
I do.
You do?
It puts blind trust back in, am I correct?
That's correct.
I do, because I do believe that it's a legitimate manner, method, that I believe was intended to be in the statute in the first place.
Mr. Chairman, if I can follow up, then am I correct then that blind trusts were taken out in judiciary, is that correct?
State affairs.
House State Affairs?
Yes, House State Affairs.
And then were not reestablished in judiciary? Were they discussed in judiciary?
Briefly, we had the Judiciary Committee was in its last day with the chairman before she left, and she was leaving on the 1 o'clock plane, Mr.
Okay, all right. So not necessarily a full committee effort there then. Okay.
Any further debate?
Thank you.
I move the amendment.
It was
objected
to.
I would like to see a definition of of blind trust in here, so there is some clarification of what that is. But I don't see it in the amendment here. But if we could maybe a floor amendment or something. But
we can have a conceptual amendment number 2. We'll be happy to do so.
Okay.
I'd like a floor amendment.
No, I don't like a floor amendment.
I know you don't,
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this section doesn't define the trust, but it gives you the elements of the trust in order for it to qualify.
That's what I thought. It was more or less a definition.
Yeah, so it is more or less. It's not included in the definition section, but it says that for a trust to qualify under this section, and then it gives you
maybe amendment number 2.
And so you may, yes, I was going to suggest just what Representative Harris did, is that you may cross-reference that as blind trust as defined in 3950.040.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Berkowitz.
There's a substantial difference, though, between the blind trust as established in 3950.040 and what this amendment suggests to do. What this amendment suggests is once you determine that a violation could exist or will occur, then the supervisor shall direct the placement by the employee into a blind trust. That's a very different situation than transferring all or portion of your assets into a blind trust for your duration of service in public office. And it's a difference between getting caught with your hand close to the cookie jar and saying, I'm not going to put my, I don't even know what cookies are in there. And I think there's a huge distinction.
No, I tend to agree with you.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Senator Seekins, excuse me.
Go back to the situation where, when you come in as an employee, your disclosure is screened to see if there's a potential violation. If there's a potential violation, the ethics supervisor says you have now 2 choices. This gives you a third. Not all your assets, but this portion of your assets could be put into a blind trust. Secondly, in the course of dealing, the employee is assigned a new task that could give rise to a violation. As soon as the employee knows that that's the case, they have to report it. It's already been disclosed, their ownership, but they have to report it to their ethics supervisor for a determination as to what they should do. And at that point, it gives the disclosure, it gives the ethics supervisor the option of saying you put that asset in a blind trust. And third, if these assets are in a blind trust in the beginning, it is not a substantial violation of the ethics code. So you could, this blind trust, if your assets are there in a blind trust and they are there at the point and at some point in time down the road, as long as they're in the blind trust, you do not have a violation of the code. And so that, it's not like you're getting your hand close to the cookie jar. In most cases, this would be the employee saying, if I do this, I have a violation.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what would be, I know maybe strange, just slightly off the amendment, but what would be so devastatingly wrong with having it just be, I mean, if a person was financially well enough off for you to vest and you had a lot of different things that could possibly be become conflict in the job that you took, with having that just be an automatic thing that happens, you'd put those in a blind trust and before the day you take office and be there until the day you didn't take until you were out of office or until you were out of the job that may have presented a conflict.
That could cause some problems there. That should be an optional issue because there could be certain businesses that you might have, say a tourist business that you might not want to put into a blind trust that you would acknowledge you had, but you still have an interest in it.
Or,
but you would obviously it would be a matter of public disclosure. So if it ever came up, you would have you'd have to deal with it as Representative Berkowitz suggests, or as the bill contemplates.
Yes.
So you wouldn't necessarily be automatically forced into a blind trust. It, where I see it usually happening is if you have a broad portfolio that would put you under the $10,000 problem, is probably where you want to go with a blind trust. But then that would be a matter of doing it up front, and what the amendment contemplates is that I think a two-way deal, and correct me if I'm wrong, Senator, that the first section there adds that if it's a financial interest, it's in a blind trust and it's out of your control and you're, it's not covered. The Section 8 stuff of your bill does allow for the establishment of blind trust after your supervisor reviews it.
Right.
So there's two different elements
two different
here.
Aspects.
Right.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could, as Representative Harris portrayed, I only own shares in my own corporation. They are worth more than $10,000, and I own a controlling interest.
Right.
I would not put them in a blind trust.
Right. I mean, there will be instances where you don't want to do that, and there would be fully disclosed, and so you don't want to have to make it automatic. Representative Corning.
Mr. Chairman, that you're entertaining a motion to amend Amendment Number 1, then, to insert that language as defined in PNAS 39.50.040.
Well, we that could be done. We could also do another amendment. We could just strip out the Section 8 language out here if we want to avoid a major concern. I do have a little bit of concerns with that. Although I know it's the sponsor's intention here to allow the supervisor to have that freedom.
It provides an alternative and that I think is reasonable and fully disclosed. That's the only reason I'm putting it there.
I understand, but it would be a matter of, I'm not sure what you gain if you have an instance where there's going to be a conflict, but the mere act of putting it in the blind trust doesn't take the conflict away if you know what's already there.
And in some cases, Mr. Chairman, I say this lightly, I've always said Senator Foghorn Leghorn's definition of a conflict of interest is no conflict, no interest. Those people who sometimes are most conflicted are the ones who are the best to have working on the project.
Right. Well, I'll see. I'm kind of there. I don't want to take up too much more of the committee's time. We have another bill on the agenda. I'm not sure we're going to get to it today. Let's disagree with Representative Wyrock. In discussion, the amendment before you has basically two different elements here. It has the first five lines have the establishment of the blind trust as a methodology of avoidance of a tripwire under the executive ethics law. The section from on page 1, lines 7 through 23 allow the supervisor to recommend in the placement of a blind trust any assets that would be in conflict. I think Representative Berkowitz, is that the primary issue that you had? Was that discretionary action there on that second section?
I'm trying to understand the third section too.
Yeah, I'm looking at that. Senator Seekins, the page 2, if you have a copy of the amendment.
We'll have a copy.
Sure, we'll get you one.
Go get one.
It's page 9, lines 3 and 4.
Well, thank you.
We're deleting establishment of mattresses. Oh. Mr. Wobey, could you help us out here? Do you have any, Senator?
Current bill.
I'm going to take a brief at ease. Come back on the record. The discussion that we're trying to determine if we're going to amend the amendment and
10B.
I would move an amendment to the amendment as amendment number 1, deleting lines 7 through 23 on page 1 of the amendment number 1. And do I hear an objection to that? Seeing none. And so moved. The amendment to amendment is adopted by the committee. Do we want to add the statutory citation? We need to make a technical correction to the amendment to amendment by going to page 3, line, or check that, page 2, line 2, and delete that also. That's just a renumbering thing.
We're going to have nothing left of the amendment here pretty soon if you keep going.
No, this is actually quite important, I think. What this does is it leaves the concept of the blind trust intact and allows that as a tool that somebody can use when they enter government service. And so, therefore, if you have a blind trust in place after you've taken a position, which is currently allowed by statute, this allows you to operate. It doesn't give you the discretion. So I think it's consistent with that. And I'm not sure we need to add a citation on that line 3, page 1 of the current statute. Anybody have a recommendation there? My assumption that the blind trust would be defined by 3950-040.
I would think that that would, I mean, since it's in the same.
Yeah, it's in the same chapter, isn't it? I don't think we need to do that. So it's subsumed by the chapter.
Technically, if it's in the same chapter, I think you're okay. You, for redundancy, you may want to reference it and leave it up to the drafter.
Well, yeah, I think it's fine. We'll look into that. And with that, before I take final action on Amendment Number 1, we'll have some minor discussion afterwards about any further amendments and relating to definitions. So,
Mr. Chairman, you're leaving in lines 4 through 8 on page 2?
That's correct. Therefore, is the objections maintained to Amendment Number 1 as amended? Seeing no objections being maintained, Amendment Number 1 as amended is hereby adopted. Is there a desire, Representative Berkowitz, to go further and define, or do you think that the current statute is adequate for defining what a blind trust is?
I think it adequately sets forth, and if there's a problem, we'll look into it, and I'll let you know.
Right, because we adopt the American Bankers Association definition, but it seems to me that the statutory definition should be adequate.
It's much better.
Yeah. At this juncture.
Senator Seegans, the one thing you want to avoid on this bill is having the chairman amend it on the floor.
Yeah.
Yeah, that won't happen. We're not getting into that, Mr. Speaker. Okay. Well, with that.
I might have to send it back to rules again.
Yeah.
You never can tell. With that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berkowitz.
Yeah, I have a conceptual amendment, and I apologize for not being able to sort through my papers here quickly enough, but it's my understanding that when there was removal of the criminal sanctions for people who made mention of the complaint, there was inadvertently left in a section that allowed for the filing of a civil complaint against an individual.
Senator Seekins, you know anything about that? I thought there was a civil fine. There wasn't a criminal complaint. It was a civil fine of $5,000 that was taken out.
There's nothing that I'm aware of. If Representative Berkowitz could direct me to it, I'd be more than happy to look at it. But I don't recall that there's anything to that effect.
I think that's confusion there. It was a civil fine.
The fine itself was taken out, but the possibility of a civil complaint with compensatory damages and all that still remains in.
Where?
In the bill.
Would it be on page 8, section, or line 9, wrongful use of the complaint?
Mr. Chair, I've been reading another bill a lot these days, not this one.
Chairman, this is a problem. You know, most people refer to this bill on what they read in the newspaper.
No editorial comments allowed.
Page 7, line 5 through 8, page 8, line 8.
There still is a wrongful use of the complaint if it's a frivolous complaint.
And how is that sanctioned? Under the current law is.
I don't know. I'd have to look. You'd be subject to a civil penalty, a civil.
Who would determine if it was frivolous?
Personnel board, as I understand.
Personnel board.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is. Yeah, there should already be provisions of the statute for that.
It just amplifies current statute.
I believe it's frivolous. You read that in conjunction with section 15, which talks of if the complainant made a factual allegation in the complaint, knowing the allegation to be false, or with reckless disregard of the truth or falsity of that allegation, which is that's a negligence standard. So that leaves open the possibility of a civil complaint.
The personnel board may recommend sanctions.
Well, that seems appropriate.
That was added in, I think, in state affairs and pretty hotly discussed in judiciary.
It was discussed in judiciary?
As far as at what level of reckless disregard.
Well, there definitely needs to be something in there, something in statute that
if it's false or with reckless disregard of the truth or falsity of the allegation. And the judiciary committee discussed that and decided that was the proper standard, reckless disregard.
So Representative Berkowitz, did you identified your area of concern?
One moment here, Mr. Chair.
All right, you ready to move this bill?
Almost.
I believe when you read that section in conjunction with the prior section on page 7 and 8, it leaves the complainant open to a civil suit in a way that.
Well, if you have the. Let's take a brief at ease.
Only if they're will.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this section, if you take a look at 340 under the law now. 340 requires confidentiality. This is very clearly setting out where that confidentiality is. And it's basically you can't disclose the filing, its contents, until the personnel board until there's a finding of probable cause, or unless the disclosure is communicating with the personnel board or seeking advice from attorney or lawfully representing the person. It's allowing a lower. It's allowing you under the current law. You literally, you'd be a violation if you went and talked to your attorney about it. And what we're saying is that here you can go and do this. You can break that level of confidentiality with these people on this on these bases, and then the. It basically describes where it becomes public information. It's meant to make it very clear at point 12, so to speak, in the 24-step process that which we've charted out on three pages, to be able to find it where it becomes public. And unless you make some other change to it, this still only applies to any penalty for doing this to a public employee. And under the current law, everybody is supposed to still maintain confidentiality, but there's no penalty if they break it unless they're a public employee. And this just basically is saying, here's the procedure for when it becomes public.
Right. That was your entire point, Senator, because the Section 15 provisions under 3952.410 to 440 only apply as a civil fine to a public employee.
That's correct.
Not a non-public employee or a civilian.
That's correct.
Or a citizen.
We're taking the blindfold off Brady Justice
here. That was your point earlier when you wanted to have certain level playing field or continuity where the sanctions would apply both to a public employee and to a regular citizen.
Correct.
Did you find anything else, Representative Burke?
No, but if I find something, you'll hear about it later.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think
that... for the time being, Mr.
Right. I'm sure we will. I have every trust that you will make sure that we're notified later.
Mr. Chairman?
And Senator Seekins, if you would like to work on that some more and advise the committee here, we'd certainly give that some thought.
Thanks.
Representative Harris.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move from the committee CS for Senate Bill 186 as amended. Individual recommendations and any fiscal notes that might be involved.
Any objections to moving the bill? Seeing none, so ordered.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
It is now 12:45. Harvey, is
yes, he is.
You available? Or
I'll be right back in just a minute.
Okay. Let's take a brief at ease. Back to order. And next we have on our calendar the House Bill 273. We have a committee substitute to version I.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bukakio.
Move that we adopt the version I for CS for House Bill 273. That's the 310.06 version.
Objection.
For two reasons. The first, let me speak to you and apologize for this procedural thing. But apparently up in finance, there were two amendments that were offered that passed 4-3. And were not included, and they were deemed to have failed in finance. And it's a very clear rule of the legislature that all you need to pass an amendment is a majority of the quorum, not a majority of the committee.
Right.
So I'm a little concerned that these two amendments were deemed to have failed.
Let's see. We do have a CS in front of us, which would obviate that. Representative Weirach, would you care to respond to the query of Representative Berkowitz?
Representative Berkowitz is correct on that. And Mr. Chairman, if I could start, knowing there's an objection on the record, talk about the bill a little bit.
Well, could you speak to Representative Berkowitz's objection first?
I spoke. He's correct.
Okay.
They were deemed to have failed.
Okay. Representative Weirach, would you go ahead then?
Yeah, thanks. Bruce Weirach for the record, Mr. Chairman. If I could speak also to Representative Berkowitz's concerns in the context of the legislation.
Sure. Maybe,
so thanks. I asked for this hearing for several reasons. Number one, that any time you deal with permanent fund dividend checks, everybody's very interested, and a lot of us have been receiving emails about what this bill is and what it does, and I wanted to have the opportunity to appear before yet another committee to explain it, and also in hopes that any amendments could be discussed in the context of this and not do committee work on the floor. Because I anticipated that what we might get is some of those same amendments that were in finance on the floor, and maybe we could deal with those here. And Mr. Chairman, I don't, if there are going to be amendments offered or not, and you wanted to hold this bill, it doesn't matter to me if you want to have another meeting to discuss those, just so we air those thoroughly in committee and so we don't have to do the work on the floor. Anyway, what this bill would do is once somebody applies for an allowable absence, and the legislature has set forth roughly 11 allowable absence in statutes. You can go out and take care of an elderly relative. You can go out and settle a state. You can go out if you're military. You can go out if you're a student, and a whole bunch of other ones. Once you do that, you can continue to receive a permanent fund dividend check if you come back to the state and show your presence here. And then, but you can continue to do that for a period of 10 years. After 10 years, if you don't come back and establish your residency, then you don't get any more permanent fund dividend checks. What the bill is intended to do is, once you apply for a permanent fund dividend checks and then and are a resident and receive those checks and then want an allowable absence, you can leave the state for a period of time. But after a period of 2 years, once you're gone, if you don't return to the state, the permanent fund division would hold your check until you do return to the state. And once you do return to the state, establish your residency here, then any check that you would have received, having been out of the state, you would receive in total when you come back to the state. So what it does is it provides two things. One is it provides a large incentive to actually come back to the state to collect permanent fund dividends. And number two, it gives you a bonus for being here, because once you establish residency, you get all those checks when you return. And what we've discovered, and Mr. Chairman, this bill was heard in committee, in Judiciary Committee, two times last year. There were three hearings on this bill in State Affairs this year. There were two hearings on this bill in House Judiciary. So there has been lots of public testimony on this bill and public hearings. What we learned through the division and through the Department of Law, and I asked both of them to be available to the committee for questions and discussion, is that after a certain period of time, a significant number of people do not return to the state of Alaska. And they will provide data to the committee that shows exactly how many, in relative terms, do not return to the state of Alaska once they've been gone for 3 years. And then the data is significant that shows the number of people that do not return to the state. In fact, one category of allowable absence where you're a dependent of a military person living outside of the state, you would not even have to ever be in the state. You would not have to be born here. And you could receive a permanent fund dividend check simply by virtue of being a dependent of somebody who did claim the allowable absence. And so that's essentially the purpose of the bill, Mr. Chairman. The amendments that Representative Berkowitz spoke to would have extended the period of time that allowable absence would have been allowed. One was offered by Representative Cotula in Finance, one was offered by Representative Jewell in Finance. The other amendment that was adopted by the Committee in Finance without objection would have addressed in the 10-year provision and restricted it to 5 years. So essentially what is in front of the committee is the State Affairs version of this bill. And we, in talking with the many co-sponsors of this legislation, Representative Kelly, who offered that amendment, which would have restricted it from 10 to 5, say you don't get one anymore after 5 years, would defeat both the purpose of this bill and go beyond really what we wanted to do, and that is provide an incentive for people to come back to the state of Alaska and live here, get their checks, and spend the money in state. And so in talking with Representative Kelly, we pulled that amendment out, so this restores the State Affairs version of the bill before us. That's what we have here.
So this is the State Affairs version?
Correct. It pulled out Representative Kelly's amendment. And what I wanted to do for two, I wanted to, one, have a hearing in front of the Rules Committee on what the bill is, and two, not have to move the State Affairs over the Finance version and have the opportunity to discuss here as to why we're doing what we're doing.
And could you, you indicated that in regard to the comments made by Representative Berkowitz that the Jewell and Cartula amendments were rejected based on a 3-2 vote?
I can't remember the vote, Mr. Chairman.
4-3, Mr. Chair.
Oh, 4-3? They were adopted, failed with a positive 4-3? Lack of a quorum, or what was the ruling of the chair?
I can't remember there.
Well, could you explain to the committee what the substance of those two amendments were?
Maybe Mr. Pogue can come up. I think what they were, they had to do with extending the date, the number of years out a person could be gone before they collected a dividend. I think that was what the substance of the amendments. I don't have them before me. I didn't actually know this issue was going to arise.
So the...
apparently Representative Jewell's amendment said that would have allowed students to get an exemption if they spent at least 9 days in the state.
Oh, that's right. One was specific to students. I think the testimony on the other amendment, which... there was not a lot of testimony, had to do with trying to capture the idea or the notion that students are more in need of their permanent fund dividend checks than other categories of excused absences. And part of the reason that those failed, and I don't mean to be presumptuous, but generally what the concern was, what the needs-based test for receiving permanent fund dividend could not stand legal scrutiny and it would not be applied across the board. And it was always a legal problem with adoption of those amendments. If we're simply going to address students on a needs-based issue, it's hard for the Department of Law to defend that legally in court.
And the other one was represented for two and extended by a year the time period for a person to be eligible to collect a dividend covered by the delayed payment plan.
What, across the board in all categories?
All my notes.
So what are we trying to do, adopt a CS here to have before us?
So, Mr. Chairman, the Chair, Representative Harris, what this bill does is this is essentially the state affairs version of the bill, which adopted a amendment by Representative Gardner, which extended the period of time that you could one could receive a permanent fund dividend check when they're out of state, I think, to 2 years. You could collect it. So essentially you're in state 1 year, then you leave for 2 years, or 1 year, then you're gone 2 years, and then the dividend program says, okay, next year if you're out of state, we're not going to give it, we're going to hold it, hold your check for you. So it allows you a 2 year grace period. And again, the substantive basis for that 2 year period, is, as the division can testify, is beyond 2 years, the data is so compelling as the number of people that do not return to the state. Greater than 60% of the people do not return to the state of Alaska, yet still claim a dividend check.
Let's get something on the floor here so we can.
I'll withdraw my objection. We'll have this, I'm sure, some of this discussion.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, on the floor. I have a quick question about, you know, these high rates of turnover over 10 years about all these people who don't return. Do you have any comparable numbers about the number of Alaskans who, for example, are here in year one but aren't here?
Maybe the dividend program does. Ms. Barton does. Can I turn it over to them, Mr. Chairman?
There's no objection to it. There's no objection to adopting the CS, Mr. Chairman.
The CS is adopted. What's the wish of the committee? You want to hear some further testimony or move this bill?
Move it. Okay. I'll move it. Mr. Chairman, I move that we move from committee CS for House Bill 273, the / I Cook 310-06 version from the individual recommendations and attached fiscal note if there is any.
Are there any objections? Seeing none, so moved.
Thank you.
And the Rules Committee is hereby adjourned at 12:58. Please sign the book.